Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. We have a lot to get to this hour, finding a window into a very complicated world. Wars, past, present, and future are a big part of the discussion today. Rory Kennedy, the youngest daughter of Senator Bobby Kennedy and director and producer of Last Days in Vietnam, will be here later in the show. And if you thought you knew all there was to know about the last hours of that war, get ready to have your mind blown, because it is amazing. And a reminder that later this month and all month long, we're looking at the world of work. Today, we'll speak to the man with, if not the hardest job in the country, maybe one of the most politically sensitive. He's Kevin Counihan, and he's the Obama administration's new CEO of Healthcare Marketplaces for the Affordable Care Act. And yes, that includes healthcare.gov. And we're going to try to find out why America's biggest food makers have tripled the money they're spending trying to stop you from being able to read about genetically modified foods at the grocery store. But we start with a remarkable but terrifying story from our partner, the New York Times. It details the horrific violence exacted by ISIS in Iraq and how one man became the lone survivor of a massacre there. Last June, ISIS militants killed hundreds of Iraqi army recruits. The official death toll is now estimated somewhere close to 800. And the New York Times has the story of the only man who survived. Adam Ellick, senior video journalist and reporter with the New York Times, is here. Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your story centers around Ali Hussein Kazem. Who is he?
Ali is an ordinary Iraqi. He's 22 years old. He has two children and a wife. And on June 1st, he joined the Iraqi military in the right outside of the city of Tikrit.
He was on an Iraqi army base. And then what happened?
Yeah, he was on the base of what was Camp Spiker, which is actually a former U.S. military base. And he was there with thousands of other Iraqi recruits going through basic training. And about 11 days into his deployment on this base, there were rumors spreading that ISIS was nearby. So Ali and thousands of other recruits who were on this base immediately stripped into changed into civilian clothes and fled the base. And unfortunately, as soon as they got off the base, ISIS had just arrived.
Now, they were confronted by ISIS on the road, is what's in the report. They were rounded up and put in trucks. Ali says that ISIS said, "You're not in danger. We're not here for you." But that turned out not to be the case. Let's listen to Ali in his own words.
"That's my group. Each one bit the shirt of the one in front of him. You bit it, bent it down, and walked. Then they made us sit like this, the seat of death. As I turned, I saw the first guy shot in the head. The blood shot up. I thought that was the end for me. There was nothing more to fear. But then I remember my family. I kept on thinking about my family, who will care for them, what will happen to them."
Now, what you've got here, Adam Ellick, is Ali Hussein Kazem watching the videos and identifying himself, videos that ISIS itself has made of its atrocities and put out to the world.
That's correct. ISIS shot and published about a 4.5-minute video of these atrocities. You're talking about mass graves, shooting people and literally just tossing their bodies into the river. And we showed this video to Ali. And one of the most amazing things in this piece is that Ali actually recognizes himself in the video. He identifies the small group that he was split into and then sees his body laying on the ground among other corpses.
"He shot the first, the second, the third. Then he came to me. I swear he fired, but I don't know where the bullet went. The guy on one side fell. The guy on the other side fell. There was blood on me. I feel it too. My head is like this, mouth open, bloodied flies all over it. Then I opened one eye. I still remember his shoe. And then it became dark."
He played dead for about 4 or 5 hours, until basically waiting for darkness and waiting for silence. And then when he was confident that the scene was cleared, he made his way towards the riverbank, where he spent another 3 or 4 days. And in short, his whole ordeal, the whole escape, more or less lasted about 3 weeks. with the help of many other people until he finally was reunited with his family.
Now, Ali is Shia, and we should point out that he had help from Shia tribesmen eventually, but also from lots of Sunnis whom he didn't know that he could trust. He tells his own story how on the riverbank he met a man that said, "Don't go that way, they'll kill you. Don't go that way, they'll kill you. Don't go down to the bridge." Basically, fella, you're a dead man.
Yeah, the escape story, in my opinion, sort of resembles a combination of elements of Schindler's List and an Underground Railroad-style escape route where he was so desperate. I mean, he hadn't eaten in 3 days that he had no choice but to knock on the doors of local villagers who very well could have turned him into ISIS, who were on the hunt looking for him. But when you're desperate, you know, you sort of pursue desperate solutions. And he took that risk. And fortunately for him, he was sheltered by those local villagers.
And eventually returned home. Ali Hussein Kazem described to you and your crew what it was like when he saw his family again.
My 2-year-old daughter saw me, but she didn't recognize me and ran off crying. So I broke down and collapsed.
Adam Elik, it's a horrific story, but also a victorious story, a tragedy that there's only one person out of about 800 or more who survived. Final thoughts as you dealt with this story and telling it to the world.
I think we learned that ISIS is really well mobilized. They're organized. I think when they pounce on the base, they seize the equipment. They line up to 1,700 Iraqi recruits. They corral them into trucks and cars. They clearly know what they're doing. And they move very efficiently. And it also, of course, speaks to the brutality that they use.
The story of Ali Hussein Kazem is on the front of the New York Times in video and in text form. Adam Elik is senior video journalist and reporter at the Times. Adam, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
ISIS is just one of the many foreign policy concerns, or crises if you want, facing the Obama administration right now, along with an increasingly aggressive Russia and a long-promised pivot to Asia. All these conflicts and diplomatic challenges are worsening, and it seems more and more unlikely that President Obama will be able to fulfill any commitments to lower military spending. David Sanger is national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, and he writes about Washington's increasing commitments abroad in today's paper. Hi, David.
Hey, Todd.
Well, we're going to be talking about NATO and Ukraine later in the show and how NATO can confront Russia. And one point you're making in your piece is that if President Obama's trying to lead the U.S. to a new post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan era of retrenchment, the rest of the world is not going to let him.
Well, it's not cooperating. But, you know, what struck me in listening to his very interesting speech in Estonia yesterday was that if you add up all of the different things that the president has told us that the U.S. has to be committed to over the long term, and it's a pretty good list and a sensible list, you've got a set of costs, a set of commitments, and a military structure that we have to rethink that no one is sort of matching up to the commitment. So think about this. Dealing with a rising China requires a long-term presence in the Pacific that ultimately, if you believe the president's plan about the pivot, we'll move 60% of our deployed military forces into the Pacific by 2020 or thereabouts. Then ISIS is obviously going to be a continuing problem, either in its current form or whatever it morphs into, and that will require a presence not only over Iraq, which we've seen in the past month, but everyone's in agreement you can't deal with ISIS without dealing with Syria. And then finally, Vladimir Putin isn't going anywhere. He could be in office till 2024 under the current constitution in Russia. And it's hard to believe that he's going to get any less assertive about Russia's view of reconstituting some of its older borders. So that's going to be a long-term commitment.
One of the points that's very difficult here that you sort of allude to is that nobody's really thought through how to have this mix of confronting a sort of old school China, big navy, big bases. ISIS is a very different kind of conflict, sort of more of a war on terror, small forces, drones. You're not going to confront them with the Fifth Fleet. Syria, probably the same. And a Vladimir Putin in Russia that's not the same as the old Soviet threat. The chessboard is very, very different and isn't really one game anymore.
It's not one game, and you know, it never really was, but the Cold War made it seem like it was a single game. The the challenges of these three all require very different skill sets. China's the rising power that's going to be an increasing economic player and on whom we have huge economic interdependencies. Russia's a declining power. And then in the case of ISIS, you have a very different kind of terror threat.
Well, David Sanger, let's turn to ISIS, because at the moment, a lot of the analysis of the ISIS threat is that it's not a direct threat to the United States. They don't really have designs yet on the United States in their rhetoric or their advancements. At the same time, the brutality and lethality calls out for a response. This is an old debate that goes back to Bosnia, to Rwanda. Should the United States use its power to confront known atrocities? And this seems to have caught the administration off guard.
Well, it's caught the administration off guard, Todd, because nobody thought ISIS would come up this quickly. But you're right. The initial argument for going after ISIS just a month or a month and a half ago, when the Yazidis were stuck on that mountain, was essentially a humanitarian argument, that the United States could not in good conscience allow what appeared to be a possible genocide to take place. But now you have seen the argument about ISIS change to one that has more to do with a direct threat to the United States. And that would call for dealing with it very differently. In a direct threat, you go in to destroy the organization, which is just what Vice President Biden said yesterday the United States would do following ISIS, I think he said in somewhat vivid language, to the gates of hell.
Indeed.
That's a very different mission.
David Sanger is national security correspondent at our partner, The New York Times. He's been writing about Washington and President Obama's increasingly complicated set of commitments when it comes to Ukraine and Russia, ISIS, and Asia. David, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We've been talking a lot this week about genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and so have you. And we've been asking you, what do you really look at when you stop to read a food label?
This is Erin from Louisville, and the thing I read is the ingredients list. I go for things with few ingredients I can pronounce, ingredients that aren't other words for sugar.
Nick Dimitrov writes to us on Facebook, volume and weight, price per what? Very, very important. And expiration date. I'm on a low budget, so volumes are important. Well, as it turns out, the next big debate over GMOs in this country centers mostly where it's always been, on labeling and whether consumers have a right to know exactly what is in their food. Major food makers like Coca-Cola and biotech giants like Monsanto and DuPont are determined to stop mandatory labeling for GMOs in grocery stores, so much so that they've spent more than $27 million in the first 6 months of this year on GMO-related lobbying. That's roughly three times their spending in all of 2013. Carrie Gillum is national correspondent covering food and agriculture for Reuters and joins me now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Todd.
Well, the fight over labeling GMO foods is nothing new, but this latest battle seems to have come from Vermont, right?
Yeah, there was a GMO labeling law that was signed by the governor there in May.
And that's mandatory labeling. Anybody who has GMO ingredients in food has to slap it on the label.
Has to slap it on the label if it's sold in Vermont.
Well,
yeah.
How could you have a problem with that?
It seems like a lot of people do.
All right. A lot of people do for sure, including big companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Coca-Cola, and others. What's been the reaction from big corporations about little tiny Vermont's law that says people in the grocery store have to know if it's GMO?
Well, of course, they have filed suit. They promised that they would if the law passed. And in June, they filed a lawsuit to try to block the law's enactment. And so that litigation is going on, and who knows how long that will take. Vermont is trying to raise money to defend the law, and has raised over $1 million so far, but it looks like a long battle ahead there.
Now, Vermont is just the tip of the iceberg. There are lots of other states that have ballot initiatives and proposed laws themselves.
That's true. This November, Colorado, there will be a ballot initiative for voters in Colorado, and Oregon, of course, also will have this issue on the ballot there.
Well, what's at stake for these big companies? We mentioned a tripling in spending. You've detailed that in some of your reports. It's a lot of money they're spending at the state and the federal level. What's at stake for the big food giants?
Well, the food giants really say that this will cause chaos in the marketplace. And, you know, this is going to add costs for consumers, significant costs. They say it will create all sorts of confusion. They essentially would have to label then all of their products sold all throughout the United States, because it doesn't make sense with the distribution chain the way it is to obviously just label things state by state. You know, the supporters of labeling counter that it would just, you know, be fractions of pennies, you know, in terms of just putting one more piece of information onto these food products. And they claim that consumers have the right to know, and this is important information, and there should be no reason that companies should want to hide it.
So the companies say, we use corn from all over America. It's all mixed up. It goes into a melange and we make products. It's too hard for us to label individual products, and it's going to drive consumers to where? To our competitors out of the grocery store?
They think that there would be a negative connotation, right, to having a label that says, you know, made with, you know, ingredients containing genetically modified organisms. And they think it might drive consumers more to organics, to natural food products, you know, and there has been a shift in consumer spending driving increases in organics.
And one of the big arguments from the food giants in front of the FDA and the USDA and other places is that despite consumer concern, or maybe concern from consumer groups, there's never been any evidence that GMOs are harmful to anyone's health or carcinogenic or dangerous in any way. So why cause undue concern about something that's never been shown to be dangerous?
Yeah, that is very definitely their position and their argument. The people on the other side say, well, most of the scientific studies that have been done have been funded by the companies that are selling these products. There is no mandatory safety testing required by the Food and Drug Administration, and there never has been since these products were introduced to the marketplace.
So, Carrie Gillum of Reuters, as the debate is heated up again, as we mentioned, the lobbying budgets of these food giants on this issue has tripled. Where is the money going? There are the state ballot initiatives, but what do they want? They want to block these laws, and what else?
The money that we were talking about is indeed the money that is spent on the lobbying at the federal level. There is federal legislation that would block any state labeling, and they are really putting their money into trying to sell that piece of legislation at the federal level. Of course, they also are spending money on campaigns in Oregon and Colorado to try to convince consumers that it would be bad to vote for mandatory labeling in November. And then we have the, you know, legal battle going on in Vermont to try to block the law there. And there's lobbying basically in, you know, more than 20 states right now, as different lawmakers and different consumer groups in different states look at their own labeling measures.
And aside from disclosed lobbying, you know, one of the things that we saw over the last decades when it comes to climate change are big companies, fossil fuel companies and others, hosting conferences, really getting involved in the scientific community to try to sow the seeds of doubt about any data on climate change. Does that kind of effort take place in the GMO world as well, sort of on the pre-media scientific level?
Well, yes, definitely. The companies are very involved in, you know, universities funding different grants for different programs and things like that. They also last year really decided that they needed to have a more direct relationship with consumers and launched a whole multimedia campaign and a website called GMO Answers. And they're pushing that. They're going out on speaking tours to schools and just really trying to make consumers more comfortable, in their view, about what they say is the safety of genetically modified organisms.
If all these things that the companies are saying are true, you can have confidence in GMOs, they're safe, there's nothing to see here, they're good because they increase crop yields and there's no reason to be concerned, why not talk about them on labels? If they're safe, why not just talk about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, I've asked them that very same question, and a lot of people have, you know, and a lot of people have suggested that they need to go ahead and just be proactive and put the label on there and not act like it's something that people need to be afraid of. And they have just said they cannot do that, that it is misleading to put a label on there because it does make it look like there's something to be afraid of, and they're not going to do it.
Carrie Gillum, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Carrie Gillum, national correspondent covering food and agriculture for Reuters. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Todd Zwillich. Well, we're getting close to the one-year anniversary of healthcare.gov and that launch. Most Americans remember that troubled rollout, that crashing website, and the confusing enrollment process. It was far from a home run for the White House.
We're going to continue to do everything we can to repeal the president's failed healthcare law.
I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems, and I'm committed to earning your confidence back by fixing the site.
We are doing everything we can possibly do to get the websites working better, faster, sooner.
Kevin Counihan might have the toughest job in America, maybe not, but it's not easy. He's the Obama administration's brand new CEO of healthcare marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act, and he sees an opportunity amidst all the stumbles in Obamacare. And while Obamacare's left most Americans wary at best, Counihan's trying to take a long view.
Well, I think there's a lot of things to do over year two, but one of the things, Todd, I think to remember is, without stretching a baseball analogy too far, that we're in the top of the third inning in a nine-inning game. And we need to understand that that we've got a good 4 or 5 years ahead of us to implement this law, to make sure that the customer experience remains and gets easier and simpler all the time. And so, it's a long-term play.
Well, you mentioned the top of the third inning. Of course, you're already in as relief. You always want your starter to go longer than three innings. So the fact that you're in there now on this job, I want to ask about the 28% who signed up. 8 million people. It wasn't a bad number in the first year, but in a lot of ways, those might have been the people who were the most willing, the most amenable to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, for Obamacare. So it seems like the rest of the marketplace might be a little bit harder to get.
Well, you know, I think you have to look at the several different channels of enrollment. So you're absolutely right. You mentioned the 8 million that came in through the exchanges, which is about a million more than I think originally projected. There were about 5 million, as I understand it, that came through Medicaid expansion, and another roughly 5 million people that came through buying group insurance through their employers. So there's actually – not all of them were necessarily previously uninsured, but my understanding is of that 18 million, about 10 million were previously uninsured. So I think it was a very strong year. We need to recognize that all these numbers are going to continue to fluctuate. They're going to go up. They're going to go down a little bit. We're going to – some see people in the exchanges are going to migrate down to Medicaid eligibility and vice versa. But we're going to see that enrollment continue to grow every year.
What are some of the marketing issues of marketing healthcare.gov, the exchanges, or really Obamacare to people in the second year? On the one hand, you could point to success. On the other hand, you and I and everybody listening are both aware that the law is vilified in a lot of parts of the country and it's not widely supported still. So what are the challenges, the differences in marketing it in year two versus year one?
Well, I'm really I start my new job on Monday, so I'm actually probably, without meaning to be coy, I'm probably not fully able to answer that question yet, though I think I will be able to pretty soon. But let me tell you some of the things that worked for us in Connecticut, and that was to focus on a few things. One is on affordability. The second is on ease. And the third is on help or resources. And so I think the point about making health insurance more affordable and accessible is something that most Americans broadly support. So you're right. I think sometimes the law gets plebiscitized. Most people, however, understand that one way or the other, all of us that are paying health insurance are also paying for those that are uninsured and getting insurance through uncompensated care. $1,200 a year of our premiums are going to cover the uninsured who are not necessarily getting preventive care and not necessarily getting the exams necessary to uncover potential catastrophic illnesses. So I think when those things are put into context, the support for it is far broader.
One of the things that might be complicated also in the second year, of course, is people signing up for insurance, again, kind of re-upping the insurance that they've had. One of the concerns, as I understand it, is there might be some pretty broad premium swings, the amount that we pay for our health insurance. And also in the design of the plan, I got to ask you about this. The way the subsidies are designed, there's a good chance that a lot of people who sign up
for Obamacare in the second year could see their government help, their subsidies, go way down. That's the way the law is designed for some people. That might be a problem for you.
Well, I think there can be all kinds of issues that need to be uncovered, as I said, when I begin the job next week. The issues that you've raised are very legitimate issues that have, you know, some scholars and others have written about. I tend to take a long view on this, so I think that some of the little bumps and glitches that we're going to see are going to get smoothed out as people get more used to the process.
You know, you're talking about small glitches, speed bumps. One thing that might not be a small glitch that could be a huge brick wall is the Halbig case in front of the Supreme Court. Without getting too down into the details, if the Supreme Court rules that federal subsidies, government help for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, can only be offered in the 14 states where state exchanges exist, that's sort of what the case turns on. If the Supreme Court rules against the Obama administration in this case, what does that mean for your ability to sell the Affordable Care Act to patients and to providers?
Well, it's a very good question. We're seeing a number of things that are very promising. So, for example, we're seeing more and more states expanding Medicaid. We saw just recently that Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has just expanded its Medicaid offering. We're seeing more and more states becoming more engaged in trying to provide ways of offering more access to health insurance and health care. So in the instance of a court case going one way or the other, I think we'll see many states that may adopt different tactics in order to get to the same ends. So, for example, in the case that you described, it is probably very likely that we could see more states becoming state-based exchanges.
So that they can keep the federal money, in other words.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the things that I've learned in doing this now for a number of years is that there really is not a one-size-fits-all approach that works for all states in our country. And frankly, I think a key role of my job and also in implementing this law is to be sensitive to those differences and to be highly supportive of the states.
Kevin Counihan is the CEO of the healthcare exchanges under the Affordable Care Act at HHS. Mr. Counihan, you're on the mound in the third inning. We're not gonna see your curveball, are we?
Thank God.
Kevin Counihan, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
We began this hour in Iraq and will end it today in Vietnam as Saigon fell under siege.
The panic has swept from the coastal city's crowded back streets and pagodas onto runways at the airport.
Our plane is surrounded here. I don't know how the hell we're going to get out.
The final hours of the Vietnam War, as North Vietnamese forces surrounded Saigon, tens of thousands of Americans and Vietnamese who had worked with them rushed to escape. The White House ordered the evacuation of only U.S. citizens in the spring of 1975, but many American officers simply disobeyed and set up secret evacuation plans to get their comrades and friends and often unknown Vietnamese out.
I had arranged a signal with my intelligence community friends that if I said I'm having a barbecue, that meant come to a certain pre-designated place and bring your families and only bring one suitcase because we're going to have a party. But it was understood the party meant I was going to get them out.
That's Army Captain Stuart Harrington recounting his efforts to save South Vietnamese Army captains and other colleagues who, as he puts it, were dead men walking as the North Vietnamese approached Saigon. Harrington's experience, along with many others, is part of Rory Kennedy's Last Days in Vietnam, a documentary that takes us back 40 years to the moment that Saigon fell and the U.S. fled, but not before some heroic and literally uplifting actions on the part of some Americans and South Vietnamese. Kennedy, who produced and directed the film, sat down with me to talk about these firsthand stories of Vietnam, including the unsung heroism of one well-known U.S. official, and what it means to walk away from war.
I think a lot of people aren't familiar with the iconic image of the helicopter on top of what many of us think is the embassy, but in fact isn't the embassy.
I learned it was an apartment building.
An apartment building. And this film really kind of unpacks the events and how it led to that moment where there's such desperation in the streets of Saigon, so many people trying to get out of Saigon. But what really excites me about the film is these untold stories of the heroes who were on the ground, the Americans and the Vietnamese, who went against U.S. policy, which at that point was just to get the Americans out of Vietnam. There were about 6,000 Americans left in Vietnam at that point. But what the Americans, many of the Americans did on the ground, as you see in the film, is they said, you know, not so fast. We're not going to leave here without our friends, in many cases, their family, their colleagues, the Vietnamese, who they knew if they were left behind, they would be killed, they'd be tortured, they'd be sent to imprisonment camps. So they went against U.S. policy. They risked their lives in the context of the Vietnam War, which is such a dark moment in American history. It really kind of makes you proud of these Americans who did the right thing.
You tell a story of a lot of people in the chain of command, from the ambassador down to individual Marines. But you also talk to a lot of Vietnamese, some of whom might have fought alongside Americans, some of whom were relatives of wives or girlfriends of Americans, as you say, but also in some cases, the tailor, the butcher, the cleaners who they knew in their neighborhoods. They were rounded up by Americans who didn't want them to be left behind. Let's hear from one. Let's hear from Binh Po, a South Vietnamese college student, was a college student at the time and appears in your film.
There's a lot of people, they try to get their money, because if the people have money, maybe they will find a connection to get out. You know, so you want to go? Give me this kind of money. One guy said to me, the family, tell them to come to the boat dock. I was waiting for them. You know, of course, they took the money, but they never got us.
And so a lot of the ordinary citizens of Saigon, I shouldn't say a lot because there were relatively few of them who were rescued, were rounded up in many cases in vans on motorcycles by people from the embassy.
Yes. And prior to the fall, people went against U.S. policy under the radar of the ambassador. They started a black ops movement, getting people out on cargo planes. You see people getting out on buses going to these ships that were in the harbor. You see Vietnamese helicopters following the U.S. helicopters, not knowing where they were going or where they were going to land, but figuring it was better than staying behind. It's extraordinary acts of both desperation and courage that I think the film really documents.
There are several people in the film, including Richard Armitage, now famous former Assistant Secretary of State in the Iraq War under Colin Powell, who was a special forces advisor at the time and heavily involved in this evacuation. Several versions of Americans saying, what I did was illegal, but this was a moment where you suspend what's legal for what's right.
Yes, and, you know, Richard Armitage is a hero in our film. I mean, his job going back to Vietnam was to get the ships that would otherwise fall into the hands of the North and that the U.S. had given to the South Vietnamese Navy to get them back in U.S. waters. And so he went there and he said to his colleague, we need to do this. His colleague Kim Do said, fine, but, you know, the crew on these ships are going to want their families to come with them. They had a meeting point. He takes his ship to the meeting point, Consan Island. He goes around the corner and there are 30 ships that are full to the rim with Vietnamese. And he had to make the decision at that point to return the people and take the ships with him. And he decided, we're taking these folks with us. They're going to be highly jeopardized if they are sent back to Vietnam. We're going to take them with us. He didn't call the U.S. to get approval. He had 30,000 people that he and Kim Do, the two of them, are really, you know, single-handedly responsible for saving.
Has history ever recognized before this point that Richard Armitage and his partner Kim Do saved probably tens of thousands of lives in the Vietnam War?
No, it's an incredible thing, too. Because
I didn't know it.
Because I didn't know it until I started doing research on this film. But I got an email from his son about 2 months ago who said, thank you for making this film. I never knew this story.
His own son.
You know, these people come back from the Vietnam War and other wars and they don't talk about it. And I think part of it was that there was no room for heroes in Vietnam.
Well, Rory Kennedy, this is a story about leaving nobody behind, Americans in particular, and lots of thousands of Vietnamese. This is one of the tenets, of course, of the American military, as we know. How do you view that now through the lens of the story that you reported in this documentary?
You know, I mean, it's interesting to think about in today's context, but I think that the reality is what we're documenting in this story is really the exception, because we left millions of people behind. And that's an undeniable truth. And, you know, in the film, really tries not to skirt around that, because in leaving Vietnam in the way that we did, we really did abandon the people who we worked with. And although we were able to get probably about 150,000 people came out during that last 3 weeks, there were millions of more who were vulnerable and left behind and ended up in resettlement camps and re-education camps, and some were tortured and some were killed. So that's kind of the bigger context of this story. And I think that what it raises to me is the question of entering wars, because once you get to the point that we got to in Saigon, and I think you see it in Iraq today as well as Afghanistan to some extent, is that there's so few options that are good in getting out of a war, particularly one that you don't win. And I think that it then begs the question of when we're entering these wars, let's really understand what our strategy is, what our plan is, and how we're going to get out of them. And I think it also raises the question of once you've entered these conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan, what is your responsibility to the people on the ground, and what happens when you leave them, and how vulnerable they are? And when they worked with us, they're our colleagues, they're agents for us, they are the cooks, they work on every level, and then you leave and they become much more vulnerable as a result. And so to me, we have a huge responsibility to those people.
A stunning story and a harrowing story of the last 24 hours of American personnel and some forces in Saigon at the close of the Vietnam War in 1975. Rory Kennedy is director and producer of Last Days in Vietnam. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there was no room for heroes in Vietnam, but Last Days in Vietnam shows that there were, in fact, heroes there. Missed anything? A reminder, The Takeaway is available to download as a podcast, too. It's all at thetakeaway.org, where you can get it. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.